Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast, hosted by Renita Ray Davis, licensed clinical social worker, board-approved social work clinical supervisor, and facilitator of the Goddesses of Social Work supervision community. Join us as we travel through the social work journeys told by the Goddesses of Social Work community members, past and present, as they make their way toward clinical licensure.
Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. On today's episode, Dr. Jasmine Haynes joins the show. Dr. Jasmine Haynes is an assistant professor of social work at the University of North Florida. Her academic journey includes a bachelor's degree in sociology from Spelman College, a master's degree in social work from Florida State University, and a PhD in public affairs with a concentration in social work from the University of Central Florida. Dr. Haynes embodies the spirit of Afrocentric social work scholar-practitioner, viewing both her research and teaching as forms of activism. Her scholarly pursuits are propelled by two key objectives. Firstly, advancing social-emotional wellness and championing racial equity among Black youth. And secondly, exploring critical consciousness among professionals serving marginalized communities. At the heart of her work lies a steadfast commitment to social justice and a critical perspective that continually challenges conventional norms, expanding knowledge boundaries. Dr. Haynes is deeply invested in nurturing conscientization and facilitating transformative learning experiences within her pedagogical approaches, weaving together community engagement and experiential learning in her classroom practices. While her current role lies within academia, Dr. Haynes has over a decade of varying experiences working directly with marginalized youth across various age groups and educational settings. These rich experiences have shaped her journey and continue to inform and enrich her quest for social change and academic excellence. Welcome to the show, Dr. Haynes.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Haynes, I love your bio, and I especially like the phrase embodies the spirit of Afrocentric social work scholar practitioner. How does one embody the spirit of Afrocentric social work, and what is Afrocentric social work?
Yeah, I think the first way someone embodies it answers the second question first. So what is Afrocentric social work? It's understanding what it is. Afrocentric social work was coined by this Black social worker, Jerome Shealy, and he coined the concept, but then created three principles of Afrocentric social work. So it's really just understanding the importance of spirituality in Black communities, understanding that the effective approach in social work practice is just as important as your logical or rational approach. And what that means is understanding our emotions, right? So understanding how we address social issues doesn't have to be just based on data. Obviously, we know numbers and data, those things are important, but also understanding that our lived experiences and our expression of our lived experiences and how those experiences make us feel and our empathy towards each other in our community about those lived experiences are just important to integrate when we address social issues in Afrocentric lens. And then the last one, which is very fitting for this podcast, is the last principle is the identity is conceived as collective. And so we know in social work, it's very individualistic, it's very westernized, but in an Afrocentric lens, we see the community just as important as the individual. So they're almost one and not the same. And so to embody Afrocentric social work, we first must understand those three principles. Understand them, believe them, and apply them. And that's what I do in my work as a scholar. That's what I do as a practitioner, although I'm not in direct practice anymore. Much of my research involves me to still be immersed in working with young people or working with educators of young people. So that's my current practice. And even in my teaching, being able to maybe not come on the first day and say, hey, my pedagogical practice is Afrocentric social work, but it literally comes through in how I approach my classroom, how I approach students, how I build relationships, how I build community. And so if I understand that the identity The individual identity is just as important as the collective, and the collective is just as important as the individual identity. So how am I cultivating community and collective identity in the classroom, not seeing students as just individual bodies in my desk? How am I acknowledging their well-being through their effective materialism, as opposed to just their numbers and their grades, right? So their emotions, their well-being, their expressed feelings, incorporating and integrating that into the classroom. And then how am I also integrating their spirituality? Spirituality is not just about religion. So understanding the diverse spiritual beliefs and allowing everyone to feel safe and brave enough to share those spiritual beliefs in the classroom as it relates to our content. That's what it looks like in my day-to-day in the classroom. And then whenever I engage in groups and participatory research practices with young people, or whether I'm doing professional development with teachers, I'm able to also reflect and mirror that when I work, address these young people or teachers as a cohort. So nothing's really individual, everything's cohort model. How do we mobilize together? How do we express our emotions in a safe space together? How do we integrate some spiritual beliefs as comfortable as the participants feel to do so? And so it just literally, it's a part of how I approach everything. Honestly, most of us who are Black social workers are Afrocentric without using the term Afrocentric. So it's one of those things that just has a concept, a term, a terminology that was coined. And it was rooted in this sense of, when we think about social work as a profession, I love social work. I love the social work profession. But every profession or institution deserves some critique. And social work wasn't always accepting and inclusive of Black individuals and Black services. And out of that exclusion, it took Black social workers and practitioners to cultivate a space where Black practitioners can serve Black bodies that were not being served elsewhere. And in the cultivation of that space, whether that be the National Association of Black Social Workers, these different institutions and organizations, civil rights movements, the cultivation of these movements then birth this concept of Afrocentric social work. We need something, we need a lens, a perspective that's not Eurocentric, that's not Westernized, that understands how we operate and move in this country with our Black identities. So that's what Afrocentric social work is about. And that is how I embody it in my day-to-day actions and practices.
That is amazing. That yeah. is absolutely amazing. I did not know this is what I signed up for today. I'm just like clapping. I have so many questions, but I'm going to keep them brief because I want to make sure I get into your social work journey. And I'm sure I can ask some of those questions there. But one of the things about what you just talked about was the spirituality piece. And anyone who knows me and or has been listening to the podcast know that I am a spiritual being having a human experience in this social work field. And how, you know, one of the things, and I've been a social worker now for 24 years, and we just did not ask. We did not include that piece in our assessment, spirituality. We didn't include in our assessment. In fact, kind of stayed away from it because it was a lot of Christian-based. And, you know, we want to just make sure that stayed over here, and we'll do our mental health work or our substance use work, and we'll keep that over here. But over the last, I would say, decade for me and my social work practice, realizing that the spiritual piece of a person, if we're not tying that in, then we're not really touching or being effective in the work that we do with folks. How has it been bringing in the spiritual piece with teaching and in your own practice with your students?
Yeah. The way I touch upon the spiritual piece is really through the integration of content. So I'll start off by giving the disclaimer that who I see myself as is one of God's vessels here on earth in a spiritual form as well. And so everything I do in my life, no matter what stage I am in my career, is guided by God. Like, I find my wholeness and my sense of identity in God. And then I attempt to cultivate an identity of a Jesus conscious person. And for me, that means as someone who believes in the Bible and believe in Jesus's life and how he operated with empathy and compassion and social justice and service, that's what I want to embody. And so that kind of helps me because it aligns with the social work profession, generally speaking. When I go and teach, I don't project my personal beliefs onto students, but I am very clear with students that spirituality is a part of many of their clients' lives, and it's not something that can be skipped or not something that we can just bypass because of our discomfort. And that's what we experience. There's a lot of students who have discomfort with the conversation about spirituality, mostly because a lot of them see spirituality as synonymous to religion. And that's a whole nother conversation on how to unpack that and deconstruct that conversation of they're not one and the same. And so I even have a class when I teach undergrad students, social work with marginalized groups, is we're unpacking this notion that if we have religion, spirituality is a part of religion, but we also have spirituality, and religion does not have to be a part of spirituality. So understanding this dichotomy that they're not one and of the same, and that someone may consider themselves both religious and spiritual, or may consider themselves just one or the other. And the way that we can understand how to approach this with our clients is to first understand how we believe that in ourselves. So again, I might share if they ask what my beliefs are, I might quickly, vaguely share like an elevator pitch of what I just shared with you about my beliefs. But for me, it's having them explore and discover their own beliefs. And as they practice doing assessments with themselves and with each other in the classroom, then they are more comfortable in asking certain assessment questions regarding spirituality to their clients. And students struggle. They truly struggle with the spirituality component because some of them have very scarred relationships with religion. And then it's clumped into my relationship with spirituality. And so in their mind, if I'm distant from spirituality, I should not have to talk about this with a client. That's not what happens, especially if you're going to serve Black clients who we know are, I mean, as the trends, the time goes, we see trends are changing where maybe we're not as religious as we once were, but we are a religious group and spiritual group who much of our social movements were initiated in Black churches. And so I teach a whole class right this semester about culturally grounded practice with Black Americans, where at a PWI, most students in the classroom, and we know in the social profession, are white, and a lot of them have very damaged relationships with religion and spirituality. And so to learn about Afrocentric social work, where spirituality is the heart of this perspective, and to have a couple of weeks when we're just talking about spirituality and the faith that is embedded in the effective approach of Black people is very interesting. It's very interesting, and it's something I don't shy away from, but I know that it's a conflicting topic for them. You can see the discomfort in their faces. The good thing I love about my students, though, is that they ask challenging questions. What if I don't believe this? How do I navigate this conversation? When is it okay for me to say I'm going to refer a client to someone else because it's getting too heavy for me or it's getting too uncomfortable for me? With the latter question, when it's too uncomfortable, we push that boundary a bit and challenge that of what is too uncomfortable, because if we think our job is supposed to be easy day in and day out, we might be in the wrong profession for one. And even in the classroom, if we think every classroom conversation is supposed to be easy day in and day out, week in, week out, again, we might be in the wrong profession. We're supposed to have these critical dialogues, and a part of critical dialogues is the spirituality piece, because our clients may have that at the heart and soul of who they are. And if we're here to enhance their well-being, help minimize social issues that they're impacting and how they've been navigating social issues for their whole lives has been at the root of who they are spiritually, we can't ignore that. And if that's what they want to incorporate in their practice or want us to incorporate in their practice, we cannot ignore that part of who they are. And so The way that I do that is just having, again, students assess themselves and their own beliefs, and then understanding where the which spiritual beliefs do they think they would have the most challenging working with. And if that is going to be an issue, we're not going to do further disservice. We're just, then you don't work with that individual and you do refer them out. And I think what I've noticed is that students continue beyond the classroom of this. They have queries now, like based on this assignment I did in Dr. Haynes's class, or based on this conversation, or based on, I mean, we watch a whole video on the Black church, and they're just like, oh, my, I view church so differently because I didn't understand the historical context of the Black church because I did not grow up in that. And so just having exposure to things that they may not have understood about religion, spirituality, in the context of different groups, diverse groups beyond themselves, is important.
Gosh, that's, I have so many other questions, and I don't want, this is, we're just still on our first question. I don't want to get too far, because I want to get into your social work journey. But Dr. Haynes, you're doing this work in a state that is not supportive. Is that okay to talk about? And yet, even in your bio, because I want to make sure I keep you safe, right? Because
I think that is the
crux of my question. Even in your bio, you boldly say that you are Afrocentric social worker. And how are you?
How am I right now? I think that I'm here. And so what I mean by I'm here is that I continue to show up day in and show up day out, being authentic to who I am as an Afrocentric social worker, as a Black woman, as an individual who researches critical perspectives, in the sense where I'm not just training teachers in trauma-informed professional development, I'm training them on racial trauma. I'm very clear on that when I provide professional development. When I work with young people who are in after-school spaces, I'm very clear on having conversations about who they are racially, because most of them are Black youth. And so having them have those critical dialogues. And so that word critical continues to pop up. And that word critical is a word that's, currently sanctioned, in a sense, when we use it. And I think I used the word critical somewhere in the bio as well. Afrocentric social work is a critical perspective. It's something that critiques the normative of Eurocentric Westernized standards of social work. That's what critical means. That's what I've always been, is a person who asks questions. Why are we doing things this way? Why do we have to agree with this? Do we have to agree with this? And what if I don't? What does that look like? Is it anti-social work? Is it anti-American? Like, there's just all these questions that you begin to ask yourself. And I continue to do so. And I continue to teach students how to do that for themselves. So I'm not in the classroom here to project my ideologies on anyone, my beliefs. I just talk about my religious and spiritual beliefs. I'm very clear with students. You don't have to believe anything I tell you when I teach you these things. And those disclaimers have become more and more important to say right now in the current context, where I used to maybe sprinkle them in. But now at the beginning of every discussion or every lecture, it's just like, disclaimer, today we're learning about XYZ. Before I share the content that was actually in your textbook, and before we start to make connections, there are ideologies and theoretical perspectives that social work, as a profession that's, leaning more towards anti-racism, anti-oppression, and we've always been at the heart of social justice, there are perspectives that this profession you selected to be in believes and is at the core. And so everything I share is rooted in social work profession. I am not here to share my opinions. Students ask my opinions all the time. I rarely give them, especially right now, but I'm very true to, I teach most of the diversity courses. So difference and discrimination, social work with marginalized groups, culturally grounded practice with Black Americans. And so, I can't stray away from, just at the top of those courses is oppression and vulnerability and marginalization or marginalized groups. So it's, I cannot not talk about the things that I'm supposed to not talk about, if that makes sense. So that was just like a rabbit hole of a description, but it's impossible for me to be true to myself and the social profession without talking about the truth and speaking truth to power and to use the textbook and literature to support what I'm stating. But I'm never entering the classroom as in, this is Dr. Haynes' opinion. This is more so, this is Dr. Haynes helping you to create connections between what you read, what you see on TV, what you hear in the news, what you see on social media, what you experience in your personal life, and training you all how to be critical thinkers to make connections for yourself. So how am I doing? I'm doing that. Like, that's just all I can do. Does it get scary? Absolutely. Because there are people making political decisions that we don't know what their end goal is. I mean, we can suspect, but there's a little bit of lack of clarity with that. And so there's been a lot of changes in K-12 and higher ed in here. And so it's just, certain spaces in the university have had funding stripped from them, where groups who are most often marginalized have no, they've had to give away their spaces on the university campus. So maybe they had offices and spaces designated for them and their organization. We might use BSU for an example, Black Student Union, or the Hispanic Student Organization, or the Asian American Student Organization. These organizations are off. I mean, these groups are marginalized groups. And so at one point they had safe spaces to go to, intentional safe spaces. And then you're told, well, that's aligned with diversity, equity, and inclusion, and that's preferential treatment. And you can no longer have that space, that designated space on campus, because then it seems you're receiving preferential treatment in comparison to other groups. And so what happens with that, right? That we already see those changes happening. Students having to unpack their offices to do away with them. So if that is happening, what can happen to us as professors who are teaching truth to power in the classroom? That is at the heart of our actual profession. Like, we are training scholars who are about to become practitioners, or some who are already practitioners, just advancing their degree. What could happen to us who are with their trainers? We're truly their trainers. Can we be silenced, which leads to further marginalization depending on who's teaching certain classes? Could a class like Culturally Grounded Practice for Black Americans no longer be a class? These are possibilities and fears that students have relayed to me personally and relayed to social work program directors on campus. What's going to happen to Dr. Haynes' class? Will we still be able to take it? Are we allowed to take it? Like, the fears are insurmountable, and it's scary and it's sad. And I just have to put on this like superwoman straight face and reassure them everything's fine. Well, we don't know that. Like, I don't know if it's fine, but I'm just showing up day in and day out doing my job, and also what I feel like is my calling. So I have no answer to what's going to happen, but I know, I tell the students, it's funny that we technically have thought, as faculty, have been told to keep doing what we're doing, right? Like, until you receive word otherwise, keep doing what you're doing. And I don't really like that message, but that's the message we receive. But then I heard myself saying that to the students as well, like, just keep showing up. We have generations, I guess, what, Gen Z and whatever else is, whatever generations after them, these generations are very liberatory. Like, they're very radical sometimes. And who am I to silence them wanting to be anti-oppressive and anti-racist? And you just see these social justice champions, and it's beautiful to watch it in the classroom. But to know that we live in a state where it's not celebrated to be that person, it's hard. It's conflicting with our profession, to be honest. And so I don't know how I'm doing other than showing up. That's just all I got. Sometimes I'm desensitized, because as a Black person in America, it's almost not shocking. It's almost like, oh, another hurdle. And maybe all I've always known to do was to just show up, right? So seems like a long-winded answer. I hope I answered the question.
No, that was a perfect answer. And I mean, all I can say to you is thank you. Thank you. Thank you for showing up, especially for our students, because, just thank you for showing up. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
How did you get here, Dr. Haynes? Like, what is your social work journey? Because my goodness, yeah?
Yeah, so how did I get here to social work? Yeah, when I have been reflecting on this question, I'm like, how did you get here, Jasmine? So I'm from South Carolina. I'm from Summerville, which is outside of Charleston. And I grew up in pretty diverse schools. Diverse, I'm using that very loosely. Diverse schools where I was not the only Black person in the school. So that's why I consider it diverse, but it was still majority white schools. And so elementary school, middle school, those were fine. When I got to high school, so I started honors classes somewhere in middle school, but I got to high school, I continued with honors classes. And in those spaces, I was oftentimes like the only Black person. Not in the, like, so when I left class, I would go find my friends who are also Black individuals, but in the classroom itself, within my honor class spaces, I was often the only Black person, or maybe there could be one other some Black individual with me. But space is really telling, and your positionality in space is really telling. It can challenge you as an only person in a space, and in who understanding who you are and your identity, and do you deserve to be here in this space, especially when other students maybe don't make you feel that you deserve to be here. So maybe they don't make the space feel safe for you. You are spoken to condescendingly or even questioned. I mean, I've had someone in my freshman year in high school try to make a joke based off of a story we were reading, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens or something like that. And in the book, they're talking about stereotypes. And one of the stereotypes is Black people can't read. And so this one young lady makes a joke and says, yeah, Jasmine, how'd you end up in this class? Like, Black people can't read. To her, that was a joke. That was a very strong microaggression. At that term, time in life, I did not know the term microaggression, but that's just one experience that I had freshman year. So for 4 years, I'm having these experiences over and over in classrooms, but not a lot of things as Black people we experience, and we don't know what they're called. You're just going through life having these experiences. So I didn't know of the word microaggression probably until almost 10 years later. Like, I don't know. But I'm having these experiences, and all I know is that, oh my gosh, I cannot wait to graduate. And as I'm in high school, my older sister is at Spelman College. She went to the same, we went to almost all the same schools growing up. So she went to the same high school, and she knew she wanted to go to an HBCU. She's at Spelman, and I'm like, I gotta go to HBCU. Like, I just can't deal with life like this anymore. And so I graduate, I get accepted into Spelman as well. So I go to Spelman. And my sister and I are 4 years apart. So every time she graduates from something, I'm graduating. So when I graduated from high school, she graduated from college, but she stayed in Atlanta for grad school at Clark Atlanta. But I go to Spelman, and it's just such a breath of fresh air to not be the only, to be surrounded by other Black women who are also smart. And so you're not the only Black woman, Black person in the class, and you're not the only smart Black person in the class. And so we're all unique in our own way, but it's not such an anomaly to see this one Black person in a class and being questioned about your smartness and who you are. We're just all celebrating each other. It's just beautiful. And you hear oftentimes, well, HBCUs are not how the real world are. That was my real world for 4 years. And that really cultivated my identity in that season. And I needed that because my identity was so fragile in high school. And I didn't feel like I had teachers who stood up for me when they heard the comments that were in class. I sometimes had classmates stand up for me, and I didn't know how to stand up for myself. And so that was very frustrating to not have the skills to be the liberatory person I am today. But long story short, I'm in Atlanta for 4 years, and I start my major. I started majoring as an econ major. So It's an interesting, I don't know. This will be a ride. So I thought I wanted to be like a music exec, like a to scout out artists because I love music. And Half and Half like was a series that was out while I was in high school. So I'm just watching like Mona. I'm like, oh, she's so quirky and so cute. Like I just want to be like Mona. So I'm like, we don't have business at Spelman. The closest thing is econ, but we could have picked up like a business management minor. So I'm like, that's going to be what I'm going to do that. I take an accounting class and I made a C and I was like, oh no, like this is not for me. The class kicked my butt and I was like, okay, you got to figure out something else. You got to figure out what you want to do. Cause that's not it. So, well, I thought I wanted to be a music exec, but I also kept saying I was going to work for like go live somewhere in the continent of Africa and work with children. I don't know how I was going to do all these things, but in my head I was going to do it all. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to do econ for the music part and the business minor. And then I made that C. And then I was just like, okay, well, you can still help children. So let's figure out how you can do that because it's not going to be econ. And at Spelman, we don't have a social work degree. So it's either psychology, sociology, or education. And my sister, as I just stated, went to Spelman and she studied psychology. And I was like, I love her and I do a lot of things that follow her footsteps, but I'm not majoring in what she majored in. Like, I'm just not doing it. So I go to the academic advisor, and I'm just like, well, what else do I have? And so it's like between sociology and education. I'm like, let's check out sociology. So I changed my major to sociology and fall in love with the classes, like just to hear about social experiences and why we do the things we do based on our social environments and how we're socialized and to believe what we believe, to engage in the world the way we do. It was just very fascinating. And so while I'm taking on this major, I'm also doing volunteerism. So I'm really big in AmeriCorps programs at this time, like doing AmeriCorps programs back to back. Like, this is really fun. And all my AmeriCorps programs were working with primarily Black youth. So whether that be like summer camps, that be after school programs, that be reading literacy programs, I was just doing it all. I was like, okay, I got it. I like working with youth. Like I'm very sure of that. Like working with youth, specifically majority Black youth serving agencies, like this is my jam, but how do I do it? I get to senior year, time to start applying for grad school. At least that's what everyone else around me seems like they're doing. So I'm like, okay, let me apply for grad school. Although I thought I was going to stop at undergrad, I was like, I'm just doing 4 years, no more school. So I start doing my own research and I come across social work. So I applied to a few social work programs. At that time, I applied for maybe two or three in Georgia because I thought I was going to stay there. But I also applied for other programs. So Teach for America, which is an AmeriCorps program, and then City Year, which is also an AmeriCorps program. City Year is very similar to Teach for America, except for Teach for America, you go teach for 2 years. And then City Year, you're more of a teaching assistant. So like a mentor, teaching assistant situation in an underserved school. So I get accepted into all the grad schools I apply for social work, which is amazing. And I'm excited because I'm like, okay, I have some direction, some clarity. And then I'm also burned out in senior year. And I'm like, I think I need a gap year. So I applied for Teach for America, as I stated, and I went through maybe two interview rounds and did not get invited to the third one. So I'm like, oh, I thought teaching might be the thing, but okay, if that didn't work out, that's obviously not the thing. And then I got accepted into City Year. And my sister had, by my senior year in college, she had moved to Jacksonville, Florida. And I got accepted into City Year in Jacksonville. So I'm like, here again, I'm going to go where my sister lives. And so I moved to Florida and served my final AmeriCorps year because I have done all the years that I can possibly serve pretty much. And so I did my final AmeriCorps year serving in an underserved middle school. So I was in a sixth grade English language arts classroom. And for me, this gap year was just really to confirm that I didn't want to teach, because even though I didn't get accepted into Teach for America, I was still like, I don't know, maybe I want to teach. And maybe I just needed a break. And that's why I didn't get accepted to the third round. Like, I'm trying to rationalize things. And then I'm also like, and it can help me see if I really want to do social work. I don't know. We're in between the two. So I serve the 1 year as essentially a teaching assistant and mentor to middle school students here in Jacksonville. And that year I was like, oh, I do not want to teach. Not K through 12. No, no. I love, like, to this day, I have relationships with some of those young people who I work with and love them. But God did not call me to teach in K through 12 settings. Like, that is not my calling. That is not my ministry. And I learned that gap year taught me that. But the gap year also taught me that I still want to work with young people. Like, I have my heart is for them. It's just not in that capacity. And so I was really in my confirmation season, basically. And so my passion was still there for young people. And I think it was just more confirmation that I can serve them in a different capacity through mentorship, through counseling. And so social work was confirmed as the profession I should go into. And so I reapplied to grad school, essentially to the same program that I had applied to before. And since I was in Florida, I also added a Florida school to the list and applied for Florida State University. Got reaccepted to all the same schools plus Florida State. So I'm just like, am I going back to Georgia? Or am I just going to stay here in Florida? Stayed in Florida. I'm like, I can get in-state tuition because I've lived here a year now, so I'll be here. And so I went to Florida State University. And now I'm back in this environment where it's like my high school. It's just like, you know, I'm back PWI. Not the only Black person in classes anymore, but there's like three of us, maybe three or four of us at that time. And so, of course, I made some really close friends and we worked through our 2 years, because obviously I did not get a BSW because we didn't have social work. So this is a 2-year MSW program. So we trekked through together and helped keep our sanity through the program. But there was just, again, a lot of microaggressions. And this time it wasn't really necessarily towards me, but I had a Black professor who became my mentor and is still my mentor today. And just to see like how students treated him really got under my skin. It really hurt my spirit, because speaking of Afrocentric social work, so again, the effective approach, the way he led his class was very discussional. Like, say it was a policy course, and I think it was. We're having dialogue and conversation. He's not giving you tests. Like, we had papers. And he's not giving you tests with right or wrong answers. I think he maybe popped in a popcorn one time because we weren't, like, people, if they were reading, they weren't engaging the dialogue. But his spirit was very much communal dialogue. Like, we're just having conversation. And that did not sit well with a lot of people. It did it. And it got to the point where they tried to create like petitions. This group of students, their solution, anytime they didn't like any professor, there was an Asian professor they didn't like this professor I'm speaking of. Anytime they didn't like a professor, their solution was, we're getting a petition and we're signing the petition and we're going to get them fired. Like, that was just their mode of operation. And that really, even though it wasn't me, it wasn't happening to me, I felt connection to him as my mentor, and I felt some type of way about it. Like, I had to, the culture's going to call me out, but I had to snitch and tell him, like, hey, these folks out here have a petition against you because they say you don't teach well. They don't, that he doesn't teach well. Well, being indicative to Western Eurocentric classroom practices that they were accustomed to. So because it didn't fit the normative of what they were accustomed to, it wasn't well to them. And so I was in another season of my life of just like, I gotta get out of here. I have to keep having these seasons where like, I gotta go. So it's time for graduation. I thrive in my MSW program. I was like the graduation speaker because I had the highest GPA. Like I did really well because I found a profession and a major that I liked sociology. I thought I loved it. I liked sociology. And then I found social work and I was like, oh, I love social work. So I went from like to love. And because I truly loved it, you know, I wasn't going to leave the profession because of my experience with other classmates, but I just needed to get out of that university. And so it was time to get on the job market and start applying for jobs. At this point, I think I want to work at a nonprofit. I studied social work with a concentration in social policy and administration. So I really wanted to do something programmatic. An assistant director or director of a nonprofit, something I knew I did not want to do clinical, which your viewers are probably going to beat me up, but I just was not a clinical person. Again, not my ministry. And I think it's because I know how invested I get. And I was like, I know me, and I don't know if I have the emotional capacity to do clinical work. I don't go the clinical route, and I also don't get the administrative positions that I like in my mind dreamed of. I ended up becoming a counselor, not a clinical counselor, but a counselor at Job Corps, which is essentially a career vocational trade program for 16 through 24 year olds. And at this point in time, I'm like, I'm young myself. I think I had just turned 25, and I'm like, well, I'm working with 16 to 24 year olds, and I'm a counselor. Like, they're going to think I'm too young. I mean, some students did question my age, but overall, I was very well respected in this position. I worked here for 2 years. The title was career counselor. What I really did was counsel young people in their crises, in their social emotional challenges, navigating their trauma. I assisted them with a lot of interpersonal interactions because there was a lot of conflicts between the students or trainees, and between themselves and amongst staff. So it was just a lot happening. No day ever looked the same. It was just, you know, social work, that it just happens. No day looks the same. So I enjoyed the job overall. What I did not like is that when you're working for a government corporation that, you know, contracts their services through contracting agencies, Job Corps being a government program, but then contracts their services. So like our jobs are really through contractors. Those contractors have to comply to the government's, you know, policies for getting things done, services provided. And one of the compliance things were, of course, case notes. And I don't have an issue with case notes. Let me clarify that. But in this job, it felt as if the organization prioritized case notes more than the work that needed to be done to get the case note. And so you all want case notes each month. So I don't, you want March case notes by April 1st. Well, these students have fires every day. So in our caseloads were super high, of course, since in our profession, we used to have super high caseloads. So my caseloads can fluctuate, can fluctuate between like 60 through 100, depending on how many counselors we have on staff. So you want me to meet with each student once a month, document the case notes for each student once a month, and then have it by a certain date. And so the meetings were not, to fulfill that, the meetings were not going to be quality meetings. Like, you just want me to do a check-in. Hey, how you doing? How's this month going for you? That is not person I am. That's not the social worker I am. And knowing when these students come to you, they have, many of them have very severe challenges that they were navigating while staying on the center because it's a residential facility. And then for the ones who weren't living on campus, had challenges at home that may interfere with their progress in the program. So like, we're navigating all of this. And how do you want me to do that for 75 people and want someone document their case notes? Oh, you want me to work outside of the hours to fulfill this? Also, to have no life, to not have wellness, to, like, it was just so much happening. And there were so many ideals, programmatic ideals that I had to work with the young people based on their concerns that they were relaying to me that I did not have the space and the capacity to do because, hey, I can't even implement that program or intervention because I got to use case notes. And I got so frustrated, and I just felt God was speaking to me and saying, there's another way to serve the young population that you are passionate about. And it doesn't have to be in this position, in this capacity. The intervention ideas you have in your head, you can develop them in a different space. And I felt that God was telling me to go back to school, to go get my PhD, to use my dissertation to develop interventions and to, in a sense, go a research route to continue to develop interventions and implement them and evaluate them. So all the things that I wanted to do at Job Corps, and I don't have to worry about case notes. I just get to write papers about them. That's how I felt. So that's what I felt was being spoken to me. And also, like, I had been out of school like 2 years. And when I was in school, the mentor I talked about, who students were, you know, creating the petition about, he told me back then to go get my PhD. And I was like, oh, goodness, no, master's. That, each time I went to school, I was like, nope, that's it. That's just, that's all. That's all the school I got. And I had him and one other professor who were just saying, you really need to go get your PhD. The other professor was just saying, go get your PhD. The Black professor was stating, as a Black woman, you should go get your PhD because we just need more Black women PhDs. And all the things you're saying you want to do in your career, you can do that with a PhD. Like, oh, no, whatever. I don't even understand. Like, I hear you, but I don't. I hear you, but I'm not listening type situation. And everything he said was very true and accurate, as I see now. But I reached back out to that particular professor, Dr. O, and was like, okay, I wasn't listening before when you talked about the PhD. Can we jump on a call and you kind of describe to me again the benefits of the PhD? Describe to me like what I should be looking for in a PhD program, because I think I'm going to apply. And so we had this conversation and we talked, and he's like, I think you should do it. Everything, again, everything you say you want to do, you can do this with your PhD. So I pray about it, manifest my what I envision for my life. And I was just like, if I get 100% funded for the program I apply for, then I think that's the answer, like to go that route. And so I applied to only one program. This is why I tell you that I think God is very intentional with the trajectory of my life. And that's why I say I find my wholeness in God, because everything has lined up in a strange way. So I applied for one program, UCF Public Affairs program. I visited, I went back to FSU to visit their PhD program. But I'm also like, you remember what your master's program was like? Granted, it's a small cohort. It's, you know, it's not as many people that were in a master's program. But I was just like, I don't know if I want to revisit that site. So I applied for UCF. They have a public affairs program at the time that had different tracks or concentrations. So social work was one of their tracks. And the whole goal of the public affairs program, again, at that time, because the program has changed, but at the time it was to have this interdisciplinary degree where you choose a concentration, but you have classes with other people who maybe concentrate in health or criminal justice or public administration, and you learn together to learn from each other, like a co-learning space. And then you just have your concentration area where that's where your electives are taken, and your dissertation would focus on that, like social work. And so I apply there, and I also apply for this fellowship that's here in Florida. If you attend any of the public universities, you can and get accepted into the fellowship, they'll pay for your whole program. So I'm like, okay, if I get in and get this fellowship, I'm going to school. I get in and get and earn the fellowship. So I say, okay, well, cool, we're going back to school. And I go to school and I meet my, at the time she was like the program director or the interim program director. And she's a social work professor and she's researching like trauma informed. Well, she, her expertise, I don't really like the word expertise, her specialty is in trauma. And she's getting this grant for trauma-informed education or trauma-informed professional development with teachers. And she's like, well, I remember I read your application. You're interested in social and emotional learning because that's what I really wanted to do at Job Corps. Like my students, I love them. I still love them too. Like they needed some social, emotional like interventions that were very directed, but we just did not have that. So I was just like, yeah, I'm very passionate about social emotional well-being and then providing the space for that so that students can thrive academically, because otherwise we're just I don't know what we're doing. So she was like, well, I have this grant and I think you'll be good for it. And at this time, again, I did not, it's like I knew the term trauma informed, but it was like a word I was hearing, but not really fully grasping and understanding. So I start doing literature reviews and searching, and I'm like, oh, this is literally almost one in the same at this point. So she hires me on as her research assistant. So I not only have the fellowship, but I also get hired on as a research assistant. And I work with her to create a curriculum, trauma-informed curriculum for teachers, but then we're also creating a curriculum for the students of the teachers. And so we trained our research team as a whole, trained educators in a K-8 community school in Orlando, how to be more trauma sensitive and trauma informed when working with their students, but then trained them on how to engage in activities that were trauma informed. So social emotional learning activities that were trauma informed. And so everything's kind of piecemealed together. And I did that work with her for a couple of years. I mean, she became my dissertation advisor and still is a mentor to this day. But that set the fire in me. And I'm like, where did I have my most challenging experiences in schools? From high school and then grad MSW program. And a lot of things that I was experiencing were stressful and could have led to trauma in some sense. This is mostly my high school experiences. And I was learning, oh, that was racial stress, especially in high school. That was racial trauma you were experiencing. And so while you're providing this trauma-informed education, we're not talking about the racial trauma piece. Like, we weren't doing it in our work. And I was like, well, I like what we do, but I want to step it up when I do my dissertation. I want to be intentional about integrating that conversation of racial trauma with teachers, not just general trauma, not just general adverse childhood experiences. Like, all of that is great things, but adding, you know, supplementing this conversation with racial stress and racial trauma and understanding how, as educators, we may be the ones who perpetuate those experiences of racial stress and racial trauma, whether it be something we say or don't say. Because if we go back to my educational experiences, the teachers were not saying anything. And so that's really my focus. And well, one of my foci in my research now is I created for my dissertation a racially conscious trauma-informed professional development for educators. And that's what I do in the work, some of the work that I have now going on. But when it was time, you know, I defend the dissertation and it's time to go on to the next thing, I was anti-academia, believe it or not. I was anti-academia my first 2 years in the PhD program. I was like, oh no, again, I'm going to go be this executive director. And it's not like I still had this vision. I'm going to go be this ED in a nonprofit. I'm going to do administrative work, use my PhD to create programs and interventions in an agency. Like, that's just where my mind, I don't know, I kept going to that. But then by the time I got to dissertation phase, I started doing my own. I had mentors at UCF telling me to go to academia, but I also was seeing their lives. UCF is a R1, like a research one intensive. I like research. I love research, but I don't need it to be intensive. Like, so it's just like, how can I do this and not look as stressed as some of my mentors look? And I started doing my own research, connecting with other people who were working at R2s. So research two universities, still slightly intensive, but less intensive than an R1. And their life was, you know, more teaching heavy, but it just seems the people I was meeting, having conversations with, it seems like they had a lot more life for family. And I'm big on family, big on community. And I was just like, I don't want academic. If I go the academic route, I need to see what it can look like differently from what I'm seeing it as now. Because I think that's why I was so resistant to it. Because what I saw at R1, I'm like, no, I can't. And I started, like I said, researching and talking to other people. And I got sold. I said, I think I could do this. I could develop programs and interventions, what I wanted to do, research them, evaluate them. I get to work with young people when I do more participatory action research projects. So I'm still doing that mentorship that I always enjoyed doing. And I get to teach about a profession that I'm passionate about, but also teaching classes that are more aligned with the social justice element of it and the anti-racism and anti-oppressive aspect of it. I don't know. This could be in the, it's like a flexible schedule most times. So I was like, this could be the career for me. So once again, I'm in the boat of applying. I applied for two academic jobs. And I didn't get an interview for one of them. And then I get an interview for here in Jacksonville, which is where I moved from Jacksonville. I probably didn't explain this. When I left FSU with my master's, I said I worked at Job Corps. I moved back to Jacksonville, where that's where I worked at Job Corps. And then I moved to Orlando for UCF. So when I applied for the two jobs, I applied for one, I won't say where, and then I applied for one here in Jacksonville and interviewed twice, first round, second round. And then I got offered the position, which was very timely. It's not always often that someone goes straight from PhD to academic route. So I will reiterate that God has been hands all over the trajectory of my life. So I can't be thankful enough. But back in Jacksonville, where I have family, we talk about community. Like, my family is literally my everything. Like, I don't know. I mean, I did well 4 years in Orlando. I had friends that I made through my cohort, but it's just something about, for me, family and my well-being. Like, I just feel happier. I feel more joyful being near family. So that worked out. And this is my second year here at UNF on the tenure track. And again, I get to research topics that I'm passionate about. I get to teach classes that we talked about earlier on in the conversation that I'm very passionate about, despite of the chaos right now of climate. But I'm very passionate about those conversations. I'm very passionate. So I get to teach students about Afrocentric social work. Like, come on. But so I just think that the journey has taken me all over the place, all through Florida at this once I got here. I lived in three different cities, but yeah, that's how we got to where I am today.
I love it. I love your journey. I do. It was so good. And I just have the one thought and our question before I move to our next question is, I so appreciate you speaking on macro social work. So I want to be like, no, in fact, our audience wants to hear more about macro social work.
Oh,
because
nice.
in fact, I have someone who said we don't do a good enough job at the MSW level of talking about the options we have in macro social work. So
oh,
I want,
yay.
yeah,
Yay.
yeah.
So the I was fact like, oh man, I'm not clinical, but
no, we can't. Those of us who are clinical can't do the work we do unless we have macro social workers who are doing the work that you do.
Yeah,
So,
I try to explain that to students too. Like, we're all so the interconnectedness. I can speak about being interconnected over and over, but most of my students want to do micro. They want to do private practice, especially at the grad level. Like, those students, you know, they're ready to finish and go get licensed. But I remind them, as you just stated, that you can go work with someone one-on-one, but if you don't know what's going on in the world around them and how that's impacting them and to why they're even coming into your office, what good is that doing us with that one-on-one practice? So everything is interconnected, that micro, meso, macro, they're all literally a puzzle, pieces of a larger puzzle.
Yeah. And they may not realize it until they start practicing and realize it, but yeah, it is all,
yeah.
we can't have the macro. We can't have the micro without the macro. So yeah. I'm going to go ahead and move on to our next question. You kind of alluded to it a little bit. A big reason that I wanted to do this podcast was to promote the importance of community with other social workers. What communities that have social workers are you a part of, and or what communities have you created, and what have you learned about yourself being in those communities?
So in my master's program, I don't think we had a name for ourselves, but it was just my group of friends that we came together mostly through the classes. Like, I'm pretty sure I met each and every one of them in a class. And so there were like four of us, two Caribbean women, and then our Brazilian sister. And we would have vit sessions. We would have dinners. We would have happy hours. We would have crack hours. Like, it would just be these moments of community socialization and sisterhood. And to this day, I'm still connected via social media with two, but the third one is still my close friend to this day. She always tells people that she saw me sitting in class and she stared at me, because that was a class where it was just the two of us, we were the only two Black women in that class. And she said that she stared at me and said, from that day, that's going to be my friend. And she tells people that story all the time. And just saw her, she lives in DC. I just saw her in DC when I went to the SWOR conference. And so she is no longer, well, she is a social worker, but she does not do social work practice anymore. She's an attorney now, but she, like I said, lives in DC. And so when I told her I was in town, anytime I'm in DC, I tell her I'm in town, she will come and we'll just go out and catch up. And so that was one community. And then in my PhD program, this group, we do have a name for each other. We call each other our sister friends. And now that each and every one of us have our doctorate degree, now we're doctor sister friends, but initially we were just sister friends. And yeah, so Kalila is, she started in my cohort, but she was part-time. And so her trajectory was a little longer than mine. And then our good friend Itunu is a cohort after hours, but Itunu started working with me as we were both research assistants for the same advisor I talked about. And so we worked so closely on research projects with that advisor, and that it was just so easy to pull her like under my wing and have her in community with whatever Khalil and I already had started as like our sister friendship. And then it so expanded to us three. And I finished, I think, 22. So they finished 23. And we all live in different cities right now, but about once a month we connect on Zoom. And when we make the Zoom title, we call them our sister friend check-ins. Like, it's just beautiful that we connected, of course, with the common goal of getting the PhD, but we also have so many spiritual similarities that we keep each other lifted so much, not just professionally, but spiritually as well. If it's just through a group thread, a group conversation of someone saying, hey, I had a rough week, or let me tell you about this, because we all work in academia now, but let me tell you about this student situation, or let me tell you about this college. Like, is it just me? Can we talk about it? And so I can lean on them for almost anything. And what I learned about myself with being in community with them is that it is okay to lean on them. I am, so clearly community is important, but I could be very private and reserved and introverted and shy about expressing how I'm feeling. I can express it on paper. I just, you know, I can journal, I can do it there, but vulnerability sometimes is difficult for me. But being in community with those two showed me that it's one, okay. Like, I've cried in front, like, it's just okay to share what I'm feeling, my fears, my joys, my worries, just everything, and to have a community that shows me that it's okay to be vulnerable. And that's probably what I learned, like the greatest lesson I learned in being in community with them.
That is beautiful. I'm so glad you have them. Dr. Sister Friend, I would love to have all three of you on the show one day. That would be such a great conversation. But, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about when you were just talking about that, Jasmine, was, you know, at the PhD level, at the highest clinical level, we think that, you know, okay, then now I've done it, you know, but it's so important to have a peer group and or still have mentors to be able to say, hey, let me tell you about this student, or is it just me? I love how you said that. Is it just me? Or to get, so we don't have tunnel vision in whatever level of practice we're in, to be able to have those folks around us who can say, nah, it was that student. I'm just like.
Because, and that's the beautiful thing. We do call, like, if we need to call each other in and hold each other accountable, we do that very well too. I didn't even say we collaborate together too, like on paper, like this summer we'll be writing papers together. So it's more than, you know, I don't know, it's just multifaceted. And we're all, our ages are kind of widespread. So it's like a I can't say multi-generational, but multi-age, like sister friend group, which I think is beautiful. Yeah.
I love that. That is beautiful. And it's so important, so important. Jasmine, what is one belief about social work that you started on this journey with that you feel has changed the most?
One belief that I feel has changed the most would have to be that social work has to look one certain way. Again, I was super excited to start the social work profession, and I'm still very excited to be in this profession. But I didn't learn about Afrocentric social work in my program. Like, I learned about that through my own research and reading and just coming across terms for things that I already do or embody in my life. And so to learn that there are other ways of being a social worker and other ways of living as a social worker and practicing as a social worker, whether that be social work, direct practice or education or scholarly practices, that there's just more than one way to do it. And that the other way, quote unquote, the other way is not wrong. It's just different. And it may, that difference may make a difference in someone's life beyond that traditional way of operating a social work. So that's something I've had to learn within my own journey and navigation of social work. And sometimes, you know, going back and forth with my own beliefs about certain social work practices, or even just something as simple as, you know, learning the pioneer of social work as Jane Addams. which is yes, but knowing that there are other really great people who were in the trenches, again, when Black people were excluded, doing the ground and legwork for Black people, like a Gertrude Brown, who is also could be considered a pioneer of social work as well, but again, didn't learn about her in my classes. And so I'm very intentional of exposing students to different names and different ways of doing and being social workers, because I didn't know myself for some time. Yeah.
Oh, I am loving this. I am so much. And, you know, as we move into our last question, I have just so enjoyed this conversation with you, but I kind of want to lean into that a little bit. Like, one of the honors that I've had in doing this podcast is meeting some amazing Black and Brown social workers who are decolonizing social work practice. And, you know, often the question that I have for them, because the way they teach us social work and really just drill it in our head that this is the way that you do it, does not look like how it is practiced in our communities, because our clients aren't westernized. They're Black and Brown folks as well. And so the last question I have for you is, what advice could you give our audience, specifically Black clinicians who might be struggling with showing up as their authentic self, thinking that they're the imposter syndrome, because their social work practice doesn't look like what the textbook said that it should look like, and are just even speaking, you know, negative stuff over themselves because it does look different than what we were taught. What advice would you give to those social workers?
Yeah, I think a lot of Black clinicians and social work practitioners want to be very liberatory in their practices and have a fear of doing so. And they want to engage in Black liberatory practices. So my advice is to first go through your own Black liberatory journey. And what I mean by that is, when we think about Black liberation, we often kind of compartmentalize that into three steps, right? So self-realization, just realizing who you are, your potential, the gravity and the weight that you carry as callings and ministries and whatever we want to call this thing in our lives that leads us into social work, realizing the beauty in that there's great potential regardless of what society says. And society might be social work sometimes. So regardless of what people or institutions state about who you are as a Black person, realizing the power that you hold just in your being. And then when we go on to, we think about Black liberation, we think about self-actualization. So once I realize who I am and what's inside and what I am capable of and the ancestors who have gone before me, then I can actualize my goals and my visions and I can really make them happen. It's okay for me to make them happen. And with the support in the right community around me, the right tools, I can actualize those goals and those visions. And if that is being a Black liberatory practitioner or an Afrocentric social work practitioner or whatever titles we want to use, I can actualize and do that. I can do those things. And then so once I actualize them, like just having that self-fulfillment and just a sense of being, like a happiness about a sense of being. So I realized who I am, I've actualized that, but I am who I am authentically, and I'm happy with who that person is. So if I'm happy with who that person is as an individual, then as a practitioner, I'm going to show up, again, authentically me. I'm going to do the practices that I know resonate with who I am and my beliefs and my values, and that also resonate with my clients, who are oftentimes, as you stated, Black and Brown individuals. I'm going to do what's true to them, not what's true to the quote-unquote perceived dominant society. And that in and of itself is fulfilling. That brings joy to us. It is sad when we minimize or dim our lights because of fear of imposter syndrome or fear of being invalidated. But if we go through that process of Black liberation, self-realization, the self-actualization, and the self-fulfillment, We can do wonders. We can do wonders. And that's really my advice, is to go through that process as an individual and then go through that, apply that process as a professional. And we will just continue to move mountains. So, you know.
When's your book coming out, Dr. Haynes? When's your book
Oh,
coming out?
man.
Yeah.
That's something on, speaking of self-actualization, that's a goal. A goal written down. One day.
That was perfect. You laid it out with step by step. And it reminded me, and I'm just going to shout. We're going to shout her out. And you probably are one who recommended this book, but The Pain We Carry.
The Pain We Carry.
Yeah.
So good. Yes.
Healing from Complex PTSD for People of Color. That
I
step
got
by
that book
step.
For Dr. Yolanda.
And
I bought her that book.
She recommended it to me, and I've been doing the meditations. It is a step-by-step
Yes.
process of healing, of, you know, PTSD for people of color and the trauma we experience as being Black and Brown
Yes.
people in America. And just now, the way you laid it out, I was like, when's your book coming? When is your
Yes,
book
yes.
coming? So I'm gonna be looking for it. I'm gonna be looking for it.
When it comes, you'll be the first to know. Well, the first
One of
outside of family to know.
the
Outside of family to know. Oh, one day, yes. That was
first. Awesome.
inspirational for asking me that. Thank you.
No, when you were doing step by step, I was like, oh man, that could just, I just saw the whole outline. And so I'm
Oh,
excited
yeah.
for you to get that into the hands of Black and Brown clinicians who need to know it's okay to show up as your authentic self in these spaces.
It is okay to be fully ourselves. We reach that fulfillment stage. We know we can do it in our, if we do it individually as our individual selves personally, we can do it professionally. Yeah.
Absolutely. A book and a TED Talk. I love it. And I'm so honored that we first got to hear it here
Oh,
on
yes.
the,
We'll mark this.
yes.
Renita had the exclusive.
Thank you so much for joining the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. This has been an amazing conversation. I've enjoyed it so much. And I'm so serious. We cannot wait for your book to show up.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on. I look forward to continuing listening to episodes. I've been listening to them. So thank you for the work that you do as well, Renita.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. We are glad you were here. If you like this episode, please come back to hear more stories of the journeys through social work, and please leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. See you next time here on the Goddesses of Social Work podcast.